Good evening, everyone. I want to thank you all for joining us once again. This is the second installment of our Pre-Shavuos Aseres HaDibros series. This year we are exploring the second of the Aseres HaDibros, Lo Yiyeh Lecha Elohim Acherim, the installment of the Aseres HaDibros that addresses issues pertaining to Avodah Zarah. And tonight our topic is interfaith relations in a cosmopolitan society. Now, before we get into any of our sources and talk about it, let me offer two personal reflections, two personal anecdotes regarding cases where I was asked shilas or asked to directly get involved in interfaith matters. And as you'll see, there is some tension between the answers that I gave or the course of action that I chose in these instances. So the first story happened a few years ago. I was in Einstein, and it was December. It was the holiday season. It was pre-holidays. And after, I think it was after Mincha on Shabbos, if I remember correctly, one of my congregants came over to me. He's not from Teaneck, but he is in-laws live in Teaneck, so he has a Teaneck connection. And he said to me, "Rabbi, I have to ask you a question." And I said, "Sure." He's like, can we come over to, he said, "Can we talk privately?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Person, Yankel," his name was not Yankel, "told me a psak of yours that I really just had to ask you about. It really didn't sit well with me." And I said, what did he say? He said, "He told me that you told him, Rabbi, that it was mutter for him to go around singing Christmas carols to his patients on, but you know, in this period before the holidays, because that's what the medical students would do and the doctors, the residents, they would try to bring some holiday cheer and spirit to their patients. So he told me that you said it was okay to sing Christmas carols." I said to him, "I actually told him the opposite. I told him that I think it was an issue to sing Christmas carols." And he's like, "Well, just so you know, he's going around telling people that you possibly that it's okay to do so." So I confronted this person, and he's not the kind to engage in any kind of like pernicious or malicious behavior. And I said, "What are you going around telling people in my name?" He says, "Well, Rabbi, I asked you the Shaila." I said, "I know you asked me the Shaila." He said, "I asked you about singing Christmas carols, and you said, yes." I said, "Yankel, that's because the question you asked me was, is it problematic to sing Christmas carols in the hospital during this season? And I answered you, yes." And after Shabbos, he looked at his phone and Taka, that was exactly the conversation. And I made him screenshot that conversation and send it to every single person that he had told that I said it was mutter. That was issue number one, where I came out with lechumra. The second story that also happened during my years in Einstein, I've shared this story before, was another time where I received a call, this time not from a congregant, but from a local politician. This time the call was from Jeff Klein, who was my local New York State senator. He was the head of the Independent Democratic Conference, which, if you know your New York politics, if you know Albany, was a power player in Albany for a long time. Now it is no longer, with shifting political tides. Now it is disbanded, and most of its members are no longer in the New York Senate, including Jeff Klein. But at the time, he was our representative in the Bronx. And he asked me to partake in an event decrying hatred towards religious minorities. It was a time when there was a lot of threats going on against Jews. There were bomb threats being called into JCCs across the country. There was a lot of threats to the American Muslim community. So he asked me to partake in this event. And he asked me to give a speech in front of the Bronx Muslim Center, which was a local mosque in the Bronx. And in this instance, I said I'd get back to him. And I thought about it. I also consulted my Rebbe, Rosenzweig, on the issue. And I said, yes, I will join you in this instance. I will come. So it was on a Friday morning. I went there. I delivered a speech. I marshaled my best, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. impression that I possibly could. I gave this very over-the-top speech about how nobody can dissolve the bonds, fraternity, and brotherhood that hold us together, et cetera. It was the most bombastic speech I've ever given in my life. It was featured on Bronx 12 Local News. So I have made it in life. I was on Bronx 12 Local News. And even though my congregants didn't watch Bronx 12 Local News, all of the Einstein babysitters did watch Bronx 12 Local News and spoke about how inspiring my sermon was. So it was definitely a rhetorical success. And I did take part in that event, which was an event, again, that brought together different faith groups that were representatives of the Jewish faith, of Christianity, of Islam, all talking about the problems, the perils of hate towards religious minorities. And despite the fact that I paskened unequivocally that one cannot go around singing Christmas carols during the holiday season, I did agree to partake in this event. So the question becomes, why did I agree or consent to participating in one, whereas I drew a very sharp line when it comes to the other? Where are these things recommended? Where are they not? What are the parameters for acceptable discourse? And where should we seek to avoid such discourse? So the main treatment of this topic for us, the main essay on this topic within our circles, however you define our circles, the modern Orthodox community, the RCAOUYU community, is an article by Rav Soloveitchik that we're going to make extensive reference to tonight. We're really going to really just try to understand Rav Soloveitchik's general position on this issue. It was an essay called Confrontation. Confrontation was an essay published in Tradition in 1964. From what I understand, it was actually the first major English language essay published by Rav Soloveitchik to a mass audience. It was only a year later that probably his most famous English essay, an essay called The Lonely Man of Faith, graced the pages of Tradition. This is before Lonely Man of Faith came out. And it was intended to address this question of how exactly we are supposed to relate to other faiths, in his case, particularly Christianity, as we will discuss in a moment, in the cosmopolitan society that we live in. Now, Confrontation itself, the essay itself, has a fascinating historical background. The historical background is recorded in a book that's called Community Covenant and Commitment. It's a book in the Me'otzah HaRav series. It publishes a number of exchanges that Rav Soloveitchik had with others, a number of letters that he wrote and public policy positions that he took. It compiles them all in a single volume. I'm actually going to grab the volume right now. Here, this is what the volume looks like. So the background to this whole essay is recorded in brief here. And if we have time, we'll see perhaps some of the supplementary materials that are compiled in this volume pertaining to Rav Soloveitchik's stance on interfaith relationships. But the basic history is the following. In 1960, there was a man named Cardinal Augustin B. He was the head of the Vatican Secretariat on Christian Unity. And he was asked by Pope John XXII, the Pope who actually made him a cardinal, to prepare a new declaration regarding the Jews. Bear in mind, there is, of course, 1,000 years of history of Catholic persecution of the Jewish people. There's deeply anti-Semitic doctrine historically that was rooted in Christian or Catholic in particular theology. And he was tasked with making a new declaration regarding the Vatican's relationship with Jews. Ultimately, this declaration would be a central piece of the Vatican II Ecumenical Council that happened in the early 60s. It was entitled, and I may be pronouncing this wrong, Nostra Aetate, which is in our time is what it means. In English, it was translated as the Declaration on the Relation of the Church with the Non-Christian Religions, and it was ultimately adopted in 1965. And the goal of this new declaration of the church was really, again, to roll back much of the anti-Semitic history that existed and the anti-Semitic content that existed within Catholic doctrine and to kind of reset the tone between Christians and Jews in the late 20th century, obviously heading into the 21st. So Cardinal B got to work trying to draft this declaration and to pass it within the Vatican. By all accounts, Cardinal B was somebody who was a Semitophile. He really loved Jews, or he certainly liked Jews. He certainly wanted to repair the relationship with the church and Jews. And I think everybody, including Rav Soloveitchik, appreciated that sentiment. As we will see, Rav Soloveitchik really did not agree with the way he approached it, but certainly the sentiment itself to try to reform some of the Catholic doctrine regarding Jews was a noble cause. But he went about it by trying to involve the Jewish community in this Vatican II Ecumenical Council. He thought the best and most effective way to actually get this passed was to involve Jews in the process. And in particular, he requested two things. Number one, he went around to global Jewish leaders, including, but I don't know if he spoke with Rav Soloveitchik directly, but including some of the umbrella bodies that Rav Soloveitchik took part in, as we'll discuss in a moment. And he asked that they pen memoranda, that they write letters asking the church to take up the issue of Catholic anti-Semitism. In other words, he was saying that if I come forward and say, oh, we need to address anti-Semitism, they're going to say, why are you worried about this? There's so many other issues we need to deal with, so many more important issues we need to deal with. Why in the world are you, Cardinal B, bringing up this question of anti-Semitism? If, however, the request came from Jewish leaders worldwide, then he'd have a more compelling case to present the College of Cardinals to say, you know, this is a real issue. Clearly, it's on the minds of Jewish leaders throughout the world. Let's try to address it. Let's bring the issue forward. So that was his first request, that Jewish leaders pen letters asking the Catholic Church to reframe their doctrine. And two, he actually wanted Jewish representation at the Ecumenical Council itself. He wanted Jews to be present, to serve as representatives of the Jewish people at this Ecumenical Council. And as we will see, Rav Soloveitchik was adamantly opposed to both. He did not want the letter drafted. He certainly did not want Jewish representation at the Vatican. He was so adamant about it that he threatened that there was an umbrella group called the Synagogue Council of America. It was an interdenominational group. I don't even know if the Synagogue Council of America still exists. I don't know if anybody knows, but it was certainly a group that was active in the 1960s. He said, if the Synagogue Council of America signs on to this, Soloveitchik said, we will pull the RCA out of the Synagogue Council of America. And similarly, he told the Religious Zionists of America that if the RZA, if the Religious Zionists of America somehow signs on to these proposals, sends some kind of delegation to the Vatican II, he threatened to pull Mizrahi out of the Religious Zionists of America. Soloveitchik then was the honorary president of Mizrahi, so Mizrahi will take no part in this. He received assurances that they wouldn't, and then Soloveitchik was very upset. They seemed to walk back on those assurances, and they did things that he did not approve of, but that was certainly his stance. And in 1964, at the RCA convention, he presented this essay called Confrontation. You can find it online. I printed it from Tradition's website. It's available on Tradition's website. He presented this paper called Confrontation. He presented this this presentation, which he entitled Confrontation. And as I said, it was later published in Tradition in 1964. And as I said at the outset, it's really that treatment of Rav Soloveitchik of this topic that I really want to analyze tonight. We're going to go through segments of the essay. The essay itself is over 20 pages long, so we're not going to read it all tonight in the time that we have. We're going to go through segments of it. I'll try to provide perhaps some broader context to some of what Rav Soloveitchik says. And then we'll hopefully return to our original question of what should our stance be towards interfaith relations in the cosmopolitan age that we find ourselves. Now, before we jump into one source number one, just one final piece of background. Confrontation, in many ways, is a truly atypical treatment of this issue. If you'd ask the overwhelming majority of poskim, what should our stance be on interfaith relations? They'd probably start with a halachic assessment of many of the issues that we started discussing last week and that we will probably continue to discuss. The questions pertain. You'd probably open a Maseches Avodah Zarah and you'd start looking through all the halachos there. What are the halachos governing losachanim and Beis Avodah Zarah, all the halachos that govern how we're supposed to relate to other faiths. And perhaps you can use those halachos to construct a theology of how exactly we're supposed to relate. Soloveitchik, who is always a very creative theological thinker, instead chose as his source material the very opening parakim of Sefer Bereishis, the story of the creation of man. Now, those who are familiar with the Soloveitchik's writings will know that those accounts of the creation of man at the beginning of Sefer Bereishis were actually one of his favorite topics. He loved writing about it. I referenced The Lonely Man of Faith before, which was, again, perhaps his most landmark essay. Lonely Man of Faith also begins with the treatment of Bereishis Perak Aleph and Bereishis Perak Beis, two accounts of creation that appear at the very beginning of the Sefer. But a year before Lonely Man of Faith, he saw this issue also through the lens of Sefer Bereishis. And in this instance, he doesn't really focus on Bereishis Perak Aleph, the account of creation that appears there, but rather internally on Bereishis Perak Beis. And as we'll see in a moment, the Rav argued that Bereishis Perak Beis presents three levels or three phases of creation. And he uses those three phases of creation as a lens to view our relationship, almost as a metaphor, to review our relationship with other faith communities. Let's take a look at what Rav Soloveitchik says. So the very beginning of Sefer Bereishis, in Bereishis Perak Beis, after the account of the 6 days of creation and plus the seventh day, which is Shabbos, interestingly, the seventh day, again, obviously the Perak breakdown in the Tanakh, is not a Jewish invention. It's a Christian invention. We don't know who exactly did it, but we use Perakim because they're convenient, because pragmatically speaking, they're easy to use, but we didn't actually break things down into Perakim. Interestingly, whichever monk decided to break down the Perakim decided that the account of Shabbos should be in Bereishis Perak Beis rather than with the first 6 days of creation in Bereishis Perak Aleph. Fine, that's why we're starting from Pasuk Dalet rather than starting from Pasuk Aleph. But in Pasuk Dalet we read, Eileh soledos ha-shamayim ha-aretz bihi bara'am, these are the accounts of the heavens and the earth when Hashem created them, on the day that Hashem created, indeed, the heavens and the earth. So there was not yet any flora. There was not yet any growth of plants because there was no rain yet and there was no man to work the ground. So then you do have some kind of precipitation that waters the earth. And then the critical psukim for us are psukim Zion and Ches. the last two lines in source number one. Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adamah v'yipach ba'apam l'shmas chayim v'yihi ha'adam l'nefesh v'yah. Hashem fashions man from the dust of the earth. He blows within him this living soul, and man is indeed this living spirit. And then pasuk ches, v'yita Hashem Elokim kan be'eden v'kedem v'yasam sham es ha'adam ha'sheyatzar. Hashem plants this garden and places Adam in the garden. This is, again, the beginning of the account of man's creation as it appears in Bereishis Perek Beis. Again, as opposed to Bereishis Perek Aleph, here we're focused on Bereishis Perek Beis exclusively. So Rav Soloveitchik opens the essay with the following. Source number two. The biblical account of the creation of man portrays him at three progressive levels. There are three levels of man's creation, three phases to the creation of man in Bereishis. At the first level, he appears as a simple, natural being. Natural man, unaware of the element of tension prevailing between the human being and the environment of which he is an integral part, has no need to live a normative life and to find redemption in surrender to a higher moral will. We'll read the passage and then we'll try to unpack it. His existence is unbounded, merging harmoniously with the general order of things and events. He is united with nature, moving straight forward with the beast and the fowl of the field, along an unbroken line of mechanical life activities, never turning around, never glancing backwards. Man, who was created out of the dust of the ground, enveloped in a mist rising from the jungle, determined by biological immediacy and mechanical necessity, knows of no responsibility, no opposition, no fear, and no dichotomy, and hence he is free from carrying the load of humanity. In a word, this man is a non-confronted being. He is neither conscious of his assignment vis-a-vis something which is outside of himself, nor is he aware of his existential otherness as a being summoned by his maker to rise to tragic greatness. So again, a lot of the language here is typical of Rav Soloveitchik. A lot of the language mirrors much of the language that he uses, and the themes also of internal confrontation and tension mirrors much of what he writes in many of his shkapic writings and many of his theological writings. But his basic point here is the following. When man is first created, man is part of the natural order. In essence, Soloveitchik argues, man was another animal. There are all these animals that are created as part of an environment. And at the outset, man exists on that plane as well. He says that man is governed by biological immediacy and mechanical necessity. In other words, just like animals are driven by some base primal drives embedded in their nervous system towards survival, towards reproduction, etc., man is initially created in that same spirit. He exists as part of natural creation. That's why the Rav argues, you'll see in a moment, he's presented as being created together with this garden, together with all the rest of creation, the flora, the fauna. Man is created as well. And as a result of that, Soloveitchik says, there's no internal conflict. There's no moral drive. There's no moral compass that man is created with. He acts on his base instinctive drives, just like any other creature would. That's why he writes, there's no opposition. There's no fear. There's no dichotomy. He has no moral compass that creates an imperative to do what's right or what's good. He doesn't even think in those terms. He's really just exists in a form of animalistic existence. This is consistent with what Soloveitchik writes in other treatments of Bereishis. In source number three, you have The Emergence of Ethical Man. The Emergence of Ethical Man is another book in this same series, what they call the Me'otza Harav series. It was a bunch of manuscripts that were compiled by Soloveitchik. They were not published during his lifetime, but they were edited and published after his lifetime. And here he presents a similar approach to the creation of man. The background to the passage in source number three is Rav Soloveitchik's discussion of two divergent philosophies of man. He contrasts the classical Greek approach to man versus the modern scientific approach. To the ancient Greeks, man was distinct from the rest of creation due to his intellect and due to his capacity to achieve higher reasoning. He was different. So there was the natural world and there was man, two entirely separate entities, and never the twain shall meet. By contrast, when it comes to the modern scientific view, the modern evolutionary view is that man is just another species. Man is firmly a part of the natural order, and he's just part of the grand scheme of biodiversity that exists in the world at large, that exists on our planet. He's just another species. So what is the Jewish view? Which one is the Jewish view more similar to? Now, intuitively, we all would have said, I think I certainly would have said, that we are more intuitive to the Greek view that in this, at least in this instance, that man is distinct from natural creation, that man is somehow greater, transcendent above it. But the Rav argues that, at least at the outset, Bereishis presents man as part of nature, as part of the ordinary natural world. Source number three. All three reports about creation, that of plants, animal and man are almost identical. He analyzes the psukim and notes that the psukim pertaining to the creation of plants on day 3 and the creation of animals on day 5 and 6 is directly parallel to, in many ways, to the creation of man on day 6 as well. All three, for example, take account of the common origin of life, namely the earth. All three exponents of living matter emerged out of the earth. Moreover, the fact that man is named Adam bespeaks his origin. If you look at the psukim, all of them reflect that it's min ha'aretz, it's from the land that they all emerge. Second paragraph of source number 3, man in the story of creation does not occupy a unique ontic position. He is rather a drop of the cosmos that fits into the schemata of naturalness and concreteness. The Torah presents to us a successive order of life emergence and divides it into three phases. The last of those living structures is man. So in other words, there's almost a quantitative hierarchy. There's plants, and then there's animals, and then there's man. But it's still all part of one continuum. The viewpoint is very much akin to modern science. Strikingly, the Rav says, again, in his argument, that is actually indeed quite similar to almost a Darwinian approach, Lahavdil, to man. And obviously, again, Rav Soloveitchik goes on to distinguish it. Obviously, we do not believe that man is just another species. But at the outset, he says, it is indeed the presentation that appears in Bereishis. And he adds, Christianity split the story of creation in two and analyzed the story of man without taking cognizance of that of animal and plant. That is why it arrived at half-truths and misinterpreted the biblical anthropology. So the Rav argues the first stage of the creation of man is man as animal. Another animal, and then there's no confrontation, there's no conflict. Man perfectly blends into his natural surroundings, into his environment. He exists like any other animal does in its natural environment. Then we come to phase 2. What is phase 2? Later in Bereishis Perek Beis, in source number 4, we read, Ha'ikach Hashem Elokim es Ha'adam, Hashem takes man, Vayanichehu v'gan Eden le'ovda u'leshomra, and he places him in Gan Eden to work and to guard. And then, Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Adam le'mor mikol etzagan achol tefel, and then Hashem commands man, saying, you can eat from any fruit of the tree. And as we know in Pasuk Yitzayin, me'etzada'as tovara lo socham imenu, ki b'yom achocham imenu mostamos, but don't eat from that one tree. Now, before we look at Soloveitchik's analysis, I want to do a comparison between two of the sources that we've looked at until now. We have two psukim in Bereishis Perek Beis that describe man being placed in the garden. One is what we just saw in source number 4, that first pasuk there, Vayikach Hashem Elokim es Adam, Vayanichehu v'gan Eden le'ovda u'leshamra. Hashem takes man, and he places him in the garden to work and to guard. But if you turn back to source number 1, the final pasuk there, in pasuk Ches, also has an account of man being placed in the garden. Vayitah Hashem Elokim gan be'eden mikedem, Vayasem Sham es Adam Asher Yatzar, and he placed man that he had created in that garden. Now, are there any significant differences between these two accounts that really just appear in close proximity to each other? One is Pasuk Ches, the other is Pasuk Tesvav. We have the Torah almost repeating the fact that man is placed in the garden. What are the differences?
Of the Ola Shamra.
Okay, good. So I hear from between Zoom and the live audience, I'm hearing two differences, both of which Rav Soloveitchik think are significant. First is that you have the word Vayikach in Pasuk Tesvav, that Hashem takes man and then places him. You don't have that word of Vayikach in Pasuk Ches. And Rav Soloveitchik will take that word as Vayikach being significant. He takes man from where he is at stage 1 and moves him to stage 2, in essence, introducing a new dimension of reality to man in Pasuk Tesvav, in source number 4. And two, perhaps most obviously, we have a charge to man in source number 4. Man is not just placed in the garden, but he's given a task. He's given work. Le'ovda u'leshomra. He's tasked not just with enjoying the garden, but also with working the garden and guarding it. And Soloveitchik argues that this reflects a second layer of man's creation. Source number 5.
It's Aaron Rothstein, I'm sorry. Hi, Aaron. Is Vayita mentioned in both? I don't have the sources.
Vayita is in the first source, not in the fourth, because that's where Hashem originally plants the garden.
So Vayita is very naturalistic.
Okay, good. So that might fit with the analysis that Rav Soloveitchik argues, that, right, again, it's presented within the context of growing flora. But in source number 5, Rav Soloveitchik really hones in on those two differences, Vayikach and Le'ovda L'shamra. The second level, natural man, moving straight forwards, comes suddenly to a stop, turns around and casts as an outsider contemplative gaze upon his environment. At this point, he's realizing that he's not just another animal neatly fitting into his natural habitat. At this very moment, the separation of man from cosmic immediacy, from the uniformity and simplicity which he had shared with nature, takes place. He discovers an awesome and mysterious domain of things and events which is independent of and disobedient to him, an objective order limiting the exercise of his power and offering opposition to him. In the wake of this discovery, he discovers himself. When self-discovery is accomplished and a new I awareness of an existence which is limited and opposed by a non-I outside emerges, something new is born, namely the divine norm. Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Ha'adam. The Rav argues that now man is recognizing, he himself is recognizing, that he is distinct from the world around him. That creates an I awareness, which is a term that the Rav uses frequently. He's aware of his own existence, of his own consciousness, of the way he is distinct from the natural order. And once he realizes that, then all of a sudden, we can begin to have moral imperative. Now we begin to have a task for man, a charge, something that he aspires to, a command that he's given. So now he's told the Ovdah L'Shomra, now he's told that he has a task to guard and to work in the garden. And then we immediately afterwards have Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Ha'adam, the first divine command. Hashem tells Adam HaRishon not to eat from the Eitz HaDa'as Tov HaRa, because now he is distinct from the natural world. So that is phase number two. And that is the beginning of the confrontation between man and the natural world around him. That is phase number two. And then the Rav argues there is a third phase as well, which is again confrontation, not between man and his natural surroundings, but between man and fellow man.
Alexa, louder.
Source number six. Vayomer Hashem. Is it Henry here? Do you want to just get the mute? Thanks. I'm just going to ask everybody to mute. Thank you so much. We'll just take care of it. I think we're good for now. In Bereishis Perek Beis, in source number six, we have the following. Pasuk Yudches. Vayomer Hashem Elokim lo tov heyos ha'adam levado ve'eselo ezer kenegdo. Hashem says, it is not good for man to be alone. I will need to make a helpmate kenegdo. I will need to make someone else to accompany him. Vayitzar, and then we have the account of Hashem creating all of the animals. Adam realizes that none of them are going to be a suitable companion for him. And then ultimately, if you skip to Pasuk of Aleph, three lines up from the bottom, Vayapel Hashem Elokim tardei malah Adam vayishan vayikach chas misal asav vayiskor basar tachena. Hashem gives Adam the first primordial instance of anesthesia. He puts him to sleep. He engages in a surgical procedure, taking one of his ribs. And then another human being is created, of course, Chava. He finally finds his companion. Soloveitchik, looking at this, says, source number seven, there is, however, a third level, which man, if he is longing for self-fulfillment, must ascend. At this level, man finds himself confronted again. Only this time, it is not the confrontation of a subject who gazes with a sense of superiority at the object beneath him, but of two equal subjects, both lonely in their otherness and uniqueness, both opposed and rejected by an objective order, both craving for companionship. This confrontation is reciprocal, not unilateral. This time, the two confronters stand alongside each other, each admitting the existence of the other. An aloof existence is transformed into a together existence. So now we don't have opposition or confrontation between man and the objective natural order, between man as subject and the natural order as object. We have two people interacting with each other and, in a certain sense, confronting the realities of one another. Now, again, none of this overtly relates to the question of interfaith relations. And again, it takes somebody with, again, the theological creativity of Rav Soloveitchik to see a message about interfaith relations here. But the Rav indeed saw this as a model for interfaith relations. He argues that, as we're going to see in passage number eight, the two forms of confrontation, the confrontation between man and the natural world, the confrontation between man and man, can almost be used as a metaphor for the relationship between different faiths. We as Jews are instructed on the one hand to confront the natural order by which he perceives general universal humanistic pursuits. That's one level of confrontation that the Jew engages in. And then there's also the confrontation between us and other faith communities, the subject to subject, that third level of confrontation, which must take place as well. And he argues that it's critical that we maintain both levels of confrontation and make sure that we have the right approach to them. The Rav really begins with a heavy critique of what I would imagine were Jews likely from other denominations, most likely, who were pushing this participation in the Vatican II Ecumenical Council. And he really has harsh words for those who think that it was the right move and who really he thinks perhaps did so out of a deep misunderstanding of what it truly means to be a Jew. Here's in source number 8 is where the Rav begins to kind of take his general theological analysis of the beginning of Bereishis and talk about how it pertains to the issues of his day, and it continues to remain a particularly poignant issue at Yom HaZeh. Source number 8. We Jews have been burdened with a twofold task. We have to cope with the problem of a double confrontation. We think of ourselves as human beings, sharing the destiny of Adam in his general encounter with nature. So that's confrontation level number 2, Adam confronting nature. So that's one level of confrontation we have. We, like the rest of humanity, confront nature. But we also do so, and as members, of a covenantal community, which has preserved its identity under most unfavorable conditions, confronted by another faith community. Of course, he's referring to Christianity here. Interestingly, in most of this presentation and essay, the Rav does not specifically refer to Judaism and Christianity by name. In much of the presentation, he talks about the faith community of the few, referring to the Jewish people, versus the faith community of the many, is the term that he uses to refer to Christianity. But for much of the conversation, he really does not label them directly. He continues, "We believe we are the bearers of a double charismatic load, that of the dignity of man and that of the sanctity of the covenantal community. In this difficult role, we are summoned by God, who revealed himself at both the level of universal creation and that of the private covenant, to undertake a double mission, the universal human and the exclusive covenantal confrontation." There are two elements to Hashem revealing himself in this world. One was creation itself, in which Hashem revealed himself to all of humanity simply through the creation of the universe. But the second is a specifically covenantal relationship, which of course we are gearing up towards, the covenantal relationship that was forged at Matan Torah when Hashem gave the Torah to his chosen people. That's a second element of our identity. So we don't just confront the world as general human beings. We maintain our exclusive covenantal identity as well. Second paragraph. "The emancipated modern Jew, however," and here Soloveitchik begins to level his critique, "has been trying for a long time to do away with the twofold responsibility which weighs heavily upon him. The westernized Jew maintains that it is impossible to engage in both confrontations, the universal and the covenantal, which in his opinion are mutually exclusive. It is, he argues, absurd to stand shoulder to shoulder with mankind, preoccupied with the cognitive technological gesture for the welfare of all." And now in today's parlance, we wouldn't phrase it as cognitive technological, but with this general project of general welfare for all, for the entirety of humanity, implementing the mandate granted to us by the Creator, and to make an about face the next instant in order to confront our comrades as a distinct and separate community. Hence, the Western Jew concludes, we have to choose between these two encounters. We are either confronted human beings or confronted Jews. A double confrontation contains an inner contradiction. He does not take the additional step of saying that the Westernized Jew does not just argue that we have to make a choice between these two, but the Westernized Jew does make a choice between these two. The Westernized Jew chooses the universal human identity over the particularistic covenantal Jewish identity. And that is precisely why they, among other things, they approach this issue of relationship with other faith communities radically different from the way Soloveitchik did. Final paragraph. "The proponents of the single confrontation philosophy, with the exception of some fringe groups, do not preach complete de-Judaization and unqualified assimilation. They also speak of Jewish identity, at least in a religious sense, of Jewish selfhood and the natural will for preservation of the Jewish community as a separate identity. As a matter of fact, quite often they speak with great zeal and warmth about the past and future role of Judaism in the advancement of mankind and its institutions. However, they completely fail to grasp the real nature and the full implications of a meaningful Jewish identity." Rav argues that when you strip Judaism of its unique components, when you just preach a Judaism that consists of universal ethics, then you lose what it means to be a Jew. The universal causes of mankind, whatever they may be, eradicating illness, striving for peace, eliminating poverty, those are all causes that we believe in as well. But if you've eliminated the unique factors of our covenantal identity, what it means to be a Jew, then you've severely compromised what Jewish identity is all about. And according to the Rav, you failed to grasp the real nature and full implications of meaningful Jewish identity. The Rav argues that a proper approach needs to maintain both of these elements of confrontation, the general identity as part of humanity and our particularistic identity as Jews in its encounter with the non-Jewish world. here he makes reference to two other stories that appear in the Tanakh. One is the story of Abraham Avinu purchasing the Ma'aras HaMachpela, and the second is Yaakov Avinu's encounter with his brother Esav. In source number 9, we read about Abraham Avinu. Vayakom Abraham al pnei Esav, vayidaber al bnei Ches leimor. Abraham approached these bnei Ches, the Hittites that were the local population, in order to purchase the Ma'aras HaMachpela. And what did he say to them? Ger bisosha anochi imachem. I am a stranger and I am a resident among you. The Rav felt that phrase, Ger Besoshav, was a particularly loaded and meaningful phrase. Source number 10. Our first patriarch, Abraham, already introduced himself in the following words. I am a stranger and sojourner with you. Ger Besoshav anochi imachem. Is it possible to be other, Ger Besoshav, at the same time? Is not this definition absurd, since it contravenes the central principle of classical logic that no cognitive judgment may contain two mutually exclusive terms? And yet, the Jew of old defied this time-honored principle and did think of himself in contradictory terms. He knew well in what areas he could extend his full cooperation to his neighbors and act as a toshav, a resident, a sojourner, and at what point this gesture of cooperation and goodwill should terminate, and he must disengage as if he were a ger, a stranger. He knew in what enterprise to participate to the best of his ability and what offers and suggestions, however attractive and tempting, to reject resolutely. He was aware of the issues on which he could compromise, of the nature of the goods he could surrender, and vice versa, of the principles which were not negotiable and the spiritual goods which had to be defended at no matter what cost. The Rav argues that a proper identity recognizes there are two levels of confrontation. There are some matters that are universal issues, and on those we participate. We are toshav. We are fully a part of the universal fraternity of mankind, and we're willing to advance those causes together with members of other faith communities and others in general. But there are other areas where we need to be very vigilant in carefully safeguarding our internal identity, and areas where we can't just go full throttle in participating with other faith groups or other groups of humanity towards their causes. We need to make sure we know where we can't compromise. And he notes, I'll just point to a particular line here, when he says, this is the first full sentence on page 4, the word that begins with, he knew. He knew in what enterprise to participate to the best of his ability and what offers and suggestions, however attractive and tempting, to reject resolutely. It seems, again, the Rav doesn't articulate this overtly, but it seems like when he says, however attractive and tempting, he's precisely talking about the historical context in which he wrote this essay. The context of Vatican II was rather attractive and tempting. Again, this attempt to really achieve some kind of detente between Catholicism and the Jewish people. Because, but no matter how tempting it is, we need to avoid areas where we can't actually, where we can't compromise, and we should not actually engage. And what defines those areas? The Rav has in my mind what's a brilliant drush on the final biblical account that he addresses in this essay. Source number 11. When Yaakov is getting ready to meet Esav, he's just spent a long time with his uncle Lavan. He has married, he has children, he's getting ready to return to his homeland. He knows that Esav is approaching him. Esav is approaching him with an army of 400 men, and Yaakov prepares. So among the things that he does is he sends tribute, he sends gifts to Esav, and he sends them in the hands of his messengers. How does he do so? Source number 11. Vayitain biyad avadav eder eder levado, vayomer el avadav evru lefanai berevat tasimu bein eder vein eder. So he sends all these flocks, all these groups of animal tribute with his messengers to Esav. And he says, place some space between the different flocks. He wants to make sure that it's an impressive gift and hand it over to Esav. And then what does he command them? Source number 11, second line. And he commands the messengers the at the vanguard, the ones who are in the lead, saying, he says, Esav is going to address you with three questions. Whose are you? Where are you going? And to whom does all of this belong? All of this, all of these animals, all this tribute that you're bringing. The Rav suggests that these questions were not just a narrow dialogue or conversation that happened thousands of years ago between Esav and the messengers of Yaakov Avinu, but eternal questions that we will always be asked as a Jewish people. Source number 12. My brother Esav, Jacob told his agents, will address to you three questions. Whose art thou? Not just to whose art thou, again, in the context of the particular story, but the Rav argues, to whom do you as a metaphysical being, as a soul, as a spiritual personality belong? And whither goest thou? To whom is your historical destiny committed? To whom have you consecrated your future? What is your ultimate goal, your final objective? Who is your God and what is your way of life? These two inquiries are related to our identity as members of a covenantal community. However, Jacob continued, my brother Esau will also ask a third question. And who are these before thee? Are you ready to contribute your talents, capabilities, and efforts toward the material and cultural welfare of general society? Are you ready to present me with gifts, oxen, goats, camels, and bulls? Are you willing to pay taxes to develop an industrialized country? This third inquiry is focused on temporal aspects of life. As regards the third question, Jacob told his agents to answer in the positive. It is a present unto my Lord, even unto Esau. Yes, we are determined to participate in every civic, scientific, and political enterprise. We feel obligated to enrich society with our creative talents and be constructive and useful citizens. Yet, pertaining to the first two questions, whose art thou and whither goest thou? Yaakov commanded his representatives to reply in the negative, clearly and precisely, boldly and courageously. He commanded them to tell Esau that their soul, their personality, their metaphysical destiny, their spiritual future and sacred commitments belong exclusively to God and his servant, Yaakov. And the Rev concludes the essay with the following. This testament handed down to us by Yaakov has become very relevant now in the year 1964. We find ourselves confronted again, like Jacob of old, and our confronters are ready to address to us the identical three questions. Whose art thou? Whither goest thou? Whose are these before thee? A millennia-old history demands from us that we meet the challenge courageously and give the same answers with which Jacob entrusted his messengers several thousand years ago. In the end, the Rav outlines four conditions that he saw as necessary for participation in these kinds of interfaith dialogues. The first condition that he said is respect for the individual features of each community rather than defining one as in relation to another. One of the main issues that is, again, implicit and at times even explicit in the Rav's writings is that even the positive feelings that were often expressed by Christians towards Jews were often expressed in their own terms. Judaism is a religion of great faith and great value because it paved the way for Christianity. It is one of the ideas that the Rav is clearly responding to when he writes this essay. And he says, again, as much as the sentiments may be warm and may be welcoming, that is not how we ever define ourselves. We never define ourselves and our religious identity as in relation to another faith. So no matter how well-intended the gestures were, the Rav was never willing to accept overtures that rooted Judaism as something that was only in relation to something else that didn't respect what he called the subject-to-subject confrontation, respecting the internal integrity of Judaism. Accordingly, two of his other conditions pertained to both making demands and acquiescing to demands. The Rav, on principle, opposed making requests of the Catholic Church that they reframe their doctrine as regards Jews. And he presents several reasons why in different places. Number one, he feels like they're entitled to form whatever theological views they want. It's none of our business. We shouldn't care. It doesn't matter to us what their theological views are. And he also viewed that mere request as a form of obsequience to the church. The fact that we're so concerned with how they view us is implied by the Rav. He says that itself is a kind of unbecoming request. To say that we are so concerned with their views and their internal theology that we are hereby coming to request you to reconsider what your internal theological views are. By the same token, he says, we have no right to forgive the blood of our ancestors. Who are we to start offering bartering and trades to the Catholic Church? They're going to reform their theology and what? Now, what are we going to do? He was very concerned about external demands being placed on Judaism as a quid pro quo for whatever changes were going to be made by other faiths. There was going to be external pressure on us to perhaps compromise on some of our doctrine as a kind of bartering or trade for some of the doctrine of the Catholic Church. He felt that was inappropriate as well. And so he formed his general stance. Again, it's in his essay Confrontation. It's in several letters that are included in this volume as well, that ironically, in the secular domain, what we call secular, he notes in a footnote, of course, nothing is truly secular. Everything belongs to the Ribono Shel Olam. But on secular matters, matters pertaining to, again, general well-being, eradicating illness, eradicating poverty, etc. On those issues, the Rav said we can, and he writes in his letters, we indeed should engage in with other faiths with similar interests in order to pursue our common interests. Those are things that we should indeed pursue. But on matters of internal doctrine, on matters of faith, on matters of theology, he gives a whole host of examples, the role of the priest and the rabbi, what our eschatological vision is, what does the end of days look like, a whole host of different examples. He says, there, we should not engage, and it would be deeply detrimental to do so. Now, I'll conclude by saying that, A, going back to my two personal reflections, it was really on that basis that I issued my, I guess, two piskei halacha, if you will, or made my two policy decisions regarding the two stories that I told you earlier. To me, singing Christmas carols is overtly religious. It's overtly religious. Again, you might say that nowadays Christmas is a secular holiday in America. I know, again, there's been a secularization of Christmas. Fine. But at its core, of course, it is a religious holiday. And the songs that they sing, there's miros that they sing for their holidays, are overtly religious as well. And therefore, I think there was no license to go around singing them to patients. I have no objection to trying to bring patients holiday cheer. But in that particular forum, I don't think a frum Jew has any business going around singing Christmas carols. In the second instance, where it was a meeting of different faith groups to advance, if you recall, security for religious minorities. To me, that fits sufficiently into the second category of something that is a secular matter, or something pertaining to general welfare, an area where we can find common ground and perhaps band together in order to form a more unified front and a stronger front in order to advance for our common needs. And I would suggest in today's society, we need to be extraordinarily machmir on both sides of the equation. Both in a cosmopolitan society, the cosmopolitan society that we live in today, I think requires extraordinary chumrah on both ends of the equation. On the one hand, we need to be very mindful of religious barriers. I won't be the first to tell you that assimilation is a major and rampant problem in the American Jewish community. We're losing Jews left and right. We're losing limbs of Klal Yisrael every single day. And again, we all know about it, but accordingly, we need to be very mindful of religious barriers. Something that I've seen quite frequently now is you see Jews, again, mostly not our kehillah. I don't know if anyone in our kehillah does this, but I've seen Jews who celebrate Christmas, secular Christmas. They have Christmas celebrations. They have their menorah there. And these are Jews who identify as Orthodox Jews, and they have secular Christmas celebrations. I've seen it with my own eyes. And again, it's just indicative of the broad cultural trends that we are combating. And these cultural trends are only gaining steam. They're only gaining force. And if we're going to withstand this cultural tide, we need to be very strong with our barriers. We need to be very clear as to what our lines are. We need to draw those lines, and we need to stick to them. As the Rav argues, we need to stick with them boldly and courageously. And we need to make sure that our proper safeguards are really guarded carefully. At the same time, and perhaps precisely because of that, on areas where we do have common ground, we should indeed pursue it. And I would say that on two planes. On one plane is purely pragmatic, as a matter of self-interest. As I was preparing this year, I came across an article in the Jewish Star talking about a Teach NYS. Of course, here in New Jersey, we have Teach NJ, which is an organization. It's a branch of the OU that lobbies for private schooling, funding for private schools, STEM funding for private schools, security funding for private schools. It's a very important organization. They're having their dinner soon. I plan to attend. I am donating. I encourage you to do so as well. They've done important lobbying for yeshiva day schools, for the schools that nearly all of us send our children to. So in New York, they don't have Teach NJ. They have Teach NYS. The headline was, Teach NYS Interfaith Coalition Visits Albany. And they had a group of course, Teach NYS, which is a Jewish organization under the auspices of the OU. They teamed up with a Catholic group, New York State Catholic Conference Director for Education, James Coltrara, and they teamed up with Islamic Cultural Center school principal. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing this name, Khadija Jean Price. All of them, and there's a photo of all of them, you can find the article online, standing on the steps of a governmental building in Albany in order to politically advocate for an area of common interest. Bear in mind that confrontation is the paper that forms the policy paper of the RCA, and the RCA and the OU are virtually closely related organizations on these matters. And obviously it was felt that this is an appropriate area where we should just be banding together to advocate for common interests. We all have private schools. We all have religious schools. We all want funding for our schools. Everybody knows how expensive it is. So let's work together in order to achieve a common goal. But I'd argue that it's also important on areas beyond just our narrow common interest. We live in a country that Rav Moshe Feinstein famously labeled a Medina Sakhasin. We live in a great nation, a nation that I would hope we all have patriotic feelings towards and has been very good to the Jewish people. And accordingly, even as we very strictly form our barriers when it comes to internal religious matters, when it comes to religious matters of faith and theology and doctrine, when it comes to general civic participation, when it comes to appreciating this country's armed forces or expressing general patriotism for the freedoms that this country has given us and all that it has done for us as Jews and for the world at large, we should be eager to participate. I think sometimes we fall short in that regard, just as we sometimes fall short in the first dimension of setting our boundaries. There are times when we're so concerned with internal Jewish causes, and there are so many internal Jewish causes, that we forget the importance of civic participation in a broader sense. Are we showing up when there are events that are intended to honor military veterans here in Teaneck on Thanksgiving? If you recall, this past Thanksgiving, I got up from the pulpit and I urged everybody to show up. Honoring veterans, appreciating military veterans of this country is not a doctrinal matter. It's not a theological matter. It's something that should unite all of us. And we need to step up and show up when it comes to those things as well. There's going to be a Memorial Day event here in Teaneck. I confess at the outset, lest I be accused of being hypocritical, I will be out of town, so I will not be at that particular Teaneck event. But if I were here, I would get up and I would go, because it's important for us to show up at these events that are matters of general human affairs in which we fully participate with all of humanity around us and all of faith groups as well. Sometimes it is difficult to do. It is sometimes a very difficult line to navigate. And I've seen it personally. You have a secular event with a prayer or invocation at the beginning. How do you navigate something like that? You have an event at the fire department intended to express appreciation for our bold firefighters who keep us safe. And at the beginning, there's going to be some blessing on the fire truck or something like that. Sometimes it's very difficult to navigate the line. It requires great wisdom to do so. But to me, in the society we live, it is critical that we strive to navigate that balance as best we can. And as I said before, be exceedingly zealous on both sides of the equation and do our utmost to uphold it. May Hashem give us the wisdom to indeed do so, and may we be so, that's always our relation to all others, in Mekadei Shemo, always sanctify his name.
Shkoach, Rabbi. Thank you.